welcome to another episode of Double Shelix Podcast. I'm Kayla.
I'm Sally, and we're here with
Katie Norton.
Dr. Katie Norton is an obstetrician gynecologist from Omaha, Nebraska. She's been in practice over 35 years. She did her medical school at University of Virginia, graduating in 1979, and then she did her residency at Michigan State and has been an OBGYN ever since. We're super excited to have her expert's opinions on the podcast, and also, she's my mom.
Shout out to Michigan State, by the way.
Yes, happy to have two Spartans in the house. Okay, so Dr. Norton slash mom, we're super excited, and we think you have a lot of awesome wisdom to share with us and our listeners.
But at the same time, listeners, remember that Dr. Norton is not your doctor. She's just a doctor, and she's just sharing her opinions. So if you have any questions, make an appointment with your own doctor, and don't sue us. Anyway.
So one of the things we most want to know from you is like what every grad student or young woman should know about women's health and their OBGYN. So what should every, like the simple question, what should we all know about women's health?
I have to say that the young women I see in my office often for the very first pelvic exam are some of my favorite people because I really have a chance to mold them and get them off to a good start. When the teenagers come into my office, we have a 3-page teenage questionnaire about where they want to go with life, if they like girls, if they like boys, if they have tattoos, are they drinking enough milk and getting calcium in their diet, and it covers a whole gambit, but it gives me a good feel for where to start with a young woman.
So the teen comes in and you give the questionnaire, or if they're not a teen and it's their first appointment, even if they're out of teenagerhood, like where do you go from there, like counseling them about their mental, women's health?
Well, I usually recommend that young women come see me before they take off for college. I think there's a lot of misconceptions out there. I like to see a young woman, let her know that she's normal, that her issues are normal, that her periods are not normal, and that we can fix them. So first of all is seeing them before they take off for college, hopefully before they've had sex, before they're in trouble with and having pain with a ruptured ovary.
Casual.
So I ask lots of general questions. I ask about what their school plans are, if they have a boyfriend, what they're using for contraception. One of the things I found is that a lot of women are very uninformed about what to do for contraception, and they're very blasé. They don't realize that 85% of couples will get pregnant in a year if they don't use something. And they just sort of wing it, and sometimes they tell me they have a contingency plan if they get pregnant, and I would rather nip that in the bud. And so I always discuss contraception, whether they're interested or just for future information. And if they are sexually active, try to convince them that they need to be proactive and protect their health.
So you said that you feel that your younger patients are uninformed about contraception. Can you please inform our listeners about contraception?
Birth control pills have been the gold standard for years and years. In the past few years, we're using long-acting reversible contraception. That would be an IUD, which now comes in a smaller size for young women, a little plastic device that fits up inside the uterus and is put in the doctor's office, an implant in the arm that has a slow release of hormones over 3 years, and frequently makes periods fairly minimal. The Depo-Provera shot that the woman has to come in every 3 months to get. And, of course, birth control pills. So we discuss the pros and cons, and if they have other issues, for example, acne, birth control pills would be an excellent treatment for that. The younger the patient, the less reliable she may be. So I like to encourage her to use the long-acting methods. For example, the implant in the arm, where she doesn't have to get to the drugstore every 28 days to refill her pills.
Kayla, this is like a lot of wisdom.
Yes. So when you're in graduate school, this might be the first time that you are either picking your own OBGYN, or maybe it's the first time that you are going to the OBGYN. So in that case, how do you go about looking for a doctor? Do you have any recommendations on what kinds of questions to ask, who to look for?
Obstetrics and gynecology is usually word of mouth. Everyone talks to everyone else and says, who's your gynecologist? Do you like her? What is she like? What is he like? usually when you're looking as a young woman looking for a gynecologist, you're not needing surgery right away. You don't need a specialist or an infertility doctor. You need someone who's going to communicate with you. So I think that's an excellent way. Talk to your friends in the lab, talk to your friends who have babies, and find out who they like and why they like them.
All right.
When you meet your doctor, what in your opinion is makes a good OBGYN? Because you might not have had any in the past. So how do you know if the one you have is good?
Someone who looks you in the eye, asks general questions, educates you, is not anxious to rush you out the door, just listen to your heart and lungs, do an exam, and send you out the door. Someone who will explain all your different options, listen to your questions, answer them. And I think a good gynecologist is frequently the only doctor that a young woman sees. So he or she needs to look at the whole person and deal with the whole issue. If the patient has a melanoma on their forehead, needs to say, oh my, you need to see a dermatologist. Or if they've got a bad heart murmur, send them off to the cardiologist.
This is good wisdom. So another thing, you mentioned with your teen patients, introducing them to sexuality and contraception and all that. But for people in their 20s, one, I feel push button issue in the news right now is pap smears. And I know, for example, Australia recently changed their national regulation on pap smears. So what do you think about pap smears for women in their 20s? Should we still be getting them? Are they passe? What's the news on pap smears?
First of all, everyone up to the age of 26 should get the human papillomavirus vaccine. Gardasil is one of the brands. It's protective against cervical cancer. It's recently also been discovered it protects against oral cancer and rectal cancer. So if you're under 26, get the HPV vaccine.
Even if you don't have a cervix?
Even if you're a boy, yes. The most important thing is to get the vaccine. If you've already had the vaccine or you're over 26, the gold standard has always been the pap smear, which is looks at the individual cells on the cervix and can figure out if they're changing or not. Recently, we've started testing for the HPV virus. So now in the U.S., we're doing two tests. It's called co-testing. You get a pap smear plus a test to see if you have HPV. Between age 20 and 30, you only get a pap smear every 3 to 5 years. After 35, you get both every 3 to 5 years. The question is, if you've got one partner, you're low risk. If you've got multiple partners, or you break up with your old boyfriend and now you've got a new boyfriend, are we comfortable waiting 5 years to see if you've picked anything up? In the U.S., some of the recommendations say wait 5 years, but in Omaha, we're just not comfortable waiting 5 years. If you miss a pap smear or do a poor job or it's poorly read, that's 10 years, and I think that's too long to wait. So my recommendation is to do it every 3 years. And keep in mind, if your possible exposure to viruses has changed, you might want to do it sooner.
Similar to your thoughts on the pap smear, what's the deal with mammograms? Because also, in other countries and even here, people are we don't need mammograms anymore. But if you say we do need mammograms, maybe you're just a peon of big mammograms. So what's the scoop on mammograms?
This goes back to, in my opinion, scientific research. What is the goal of the study that said you don't need yearly mammograms? What is their endpoint? If their endpoint is the number of women dying of breast cancer, I'd like to find breast cancer early when it's still easy to treat. So I think any medical recommendation, I think you have to look at what they're saying and what the study was. One of the problems with doing a mammogram every year, starting in your late 30s or 40, is that they might find a breast lump and they might do a biopsy and there might not be cancer there, and look at all the money we've wasted. Well, if it's my breast, I don't care. I want it checked out. They also talk about the number of breast cancers that are diagnosed that are insignificant.
What does that mean?
What is insignificant breast cancer?
Yeah.
Exactly. They mean it's one that's not going to cause you problems during your lifetime. But they have not really said how they know it's insignificant. They may know that X percent of breast cancers are insignificant and not going to change your life, but would you like a doctor to say your breast cancer is insignificant, don't worry about it?
No, that's a sign that they're a bad doctor. You talked about that.
I think it's time to take it out. I think, so the current recommendations, I still think, and I tell my patients, do a mammogram every year after age 40. Your insurance company still pays for it. We can find it early. I have a lot of patients in my practice that get breast cancer that have had recent mammograms.
Are there any cases where you should be concerned earlier than 40?
Strong family history of breast cancer. If you have a mother or a grandmother or siblings, first-degree relatives that have had breast cancer early, then they start the screening early. If you've got a lot of breast cancer in your family, then you should think about either the person with breast cancer getting checked for one of the breast cancer genes, like the BRCA gene, or if those people are not around anymore, for example, your mother and your sister have died, you can personally get checked for the BRCA gene to see if you're at high risk.
Do you feel like your experiences as a patient who survived breast cancer sort of bias your medical opinion because, like, you did have a mammogram and you didn't die of breast cancer? I mean, it sounds bad, but you know what I mean.
Well, I have a few patients that say, I don't believe in mammograms. And I just look at them and say, you're talking to the wrong girl, honey, because I've had it. But mostly I think it's really changed my practice because when I have to call a patient and tell her she has breast cancer, I can tell her what all's involved and what to look for, and I can be her cheerleader. And I've had patients ask me if I would take care of them when they had their breast cancer. I have to say, no, you need a surgeon and an oncologist, but I'm always happy to be your cheerleader and call me with questions. So it's changed the way I practice, and it's changed the way I talk to patients about getting mammograms, when to get mammograms.
In graduate school, most women are somewhere between their early mid-20s to maybe their early mid-30s. What kinds of gynecological issues might arise during for an age group or for that demographic that would be particular to that demographic?
Well, what can go wrong
yeah.
in this age group?
Yes.
So what can go wrong? If you start skipping periods completely, then you need to get in touch with your gynecologist. If you're not using birth control pills or an IUD or some method that's causing you to stop, women who quit having periods completely need to be evaluated. Horrible menstrual cramps that interfere with your life. If you're missing work, then you need to be evaluated. Pain with sex that happens on a recurring basis should be evaluated. It's not normal. It may be something simple, but it's not normal. Vaginitis, itching, burning, irritation, unusual discharges, get your attention right away. And you just need to know it can be fixed. And, of course, contraception.
Or pregnancy.
Or planning a pregnancy.
Your answers are just so good.
I've been doing this, answering these questions to my patients for years.
Yeah. Well, we said that in the beginning.
Well, I know, but I do this all day long.
Sometimes Sorry, are we boring you with our boring questions?
No, you're not. This is fun.
Okay.
Could you tell us more about how you got into the field and what was your training like and where you've been working since then?
Excellent. So I'm a California girl who went to medical school in Virginia, and that was a culture shock, very conservative. The attending physicians were very conservative. I remember one general surgeon asked me why I was in medical school.
With the implication that
you're a woman.
Yeah, that I'm a woman. And I just looked at him and said, I didn't find a husband in college, so I'm here in medical school. Which I think sometimes if someone asks you a totally inappropriate question, if you give them an inappropriate answer, it will get their attention.
Throughout your practice, like both in medical school and then in your residency, like, have you seen norms of OBGYN change or like attitudes of doctors and patients? Like, how are things changing in the last N years?
When I was in medical school, I spent the summer with a family practice doctor in Northern California, and he took me on rounds with him and took me in to see an older patient. And he said, I want to introduce you to Dr. Norton. And she looked around me on both sides and couldn't find Dr. Norton. And then he said, no, this is Dr. Norton. She's a woman doctor. And the light bulb slowly went off in her head, and she had never even considered that a woman could be a doctor. But then she warmed up to the idea and thought it was fantastic. So that's the early years. Also the early years, on my surgery rotation, they would start lecturing in the changing room, the doctor's changing room, also known as the men's changing room. So the women residents and students would completely miss out on the first half of the rounds until
they finished putting their clothes on and got into the teaching area.
Until the women got upset, but they didn't even think twice about it.
What about attitudes of like the medical practice in terms, not in terms of you interacting with other doctors, but like the way the doctors thought about patients' issues? Has anything that like that changed or?
Oh, yes. Medical issues. When I was a teenager, young women were told that menstrual cramps were all in our heads and we just needed to deal with it. And hyperemesis gravidarum, the vomiting of pregnancy that
Kate Middleton has that.
Yes.
Oh, man. It's celebrity. Okay, keep going.
The theory was it was all in their head and you needed to put a woman in a dark room and leave her alone and don't go in and talk with her and make rounds on her. And eventually she'd get tired of being so dramatic and would quit throwing up.
Like, for real?
For real.
And
now we give them chemotherapy strength anti-vomiting medication and steroids and all kinds of other things because we've realized that it's a real problem.
That it's actually harming them and their baby.
Absolutely.
So I hear that you have some experiences in Kenya. Can you tell us a little bit about that and maybe what it was like to do international practice?
Sure. For the past 8 years, I've been going to a small town in Kenya. We go with a group of about 15 professionals, couple obstetricians, general surgeons, plastic surgeons, a lot of nurses, neonatal nurses, scrub nurses. They do the best they can with very limited resources. The obstetricians are very well trained and they're up on the literature, but they don't seem to have synchronized it with actual life in Kenya. For example, when a woman gets sick with hypertension and preeclampsia, she needs to get delivered. But they have no intensive care for premature babies. So if they deliver the woman at 32 weeks at about 3 pounds, in the U.S., the baby would do great in the intensive care nursery. In Kenya, the baby's going to die. And in my opinion, they need to say, well, okay, she needs to be delivered, but the baby will die. So what are we going to do differently and how are we going to solve the problem? They also, in Kenya, there is no premature nursery, so the babies do die. But they don't say, oh, this baby's going to die. We can't do anything for him. We'll treat the baby like hospice. We'll wrap him up. We'll make him comfortable. And we'll hold him until he dies and make the baby comfortable, like we do with our cancer patients here. They just put the baby in a crib and poke him once in a while to see if he's died yet. So that's one of the things that I'm really working on, is trying to get the idea of hospice for babies. I mean, it's a terrible problem, but we need to make the best of it.
In your work there, how do you balance the line between you come from a place that has a lot of resources and you obviously have a lot of knowledge, but at the same time, like, they have the way that they've always been doing it and there might or might not be good reasons for that. So how have you found is the most effective way to sort of try to create these transitions without being like, I am smart and white and from America, do what I say and it will be better because I said so. You know, because that's like can be a problem for people that come to like help in other countries.
What we do basically is we talk about the pros and the cons, and I learn as much from them as they learn from me. So there really is an exchange. So in some ways, Sally's question solves itself because we can discuss things. And sometimes we just throw out ideas. Like, there was a patient who'd lost 3 babies and now she was at term and they didn't know what they should do with her. And I said, I think you should just do a cesarean on this woman. She's lost 3 babies. Her goal is to have a baby. So let's just do a cesarean and not worry about labor. And they said, oh, okay, that's a good idea. And some of the other things, training the nurses, it takes just getting your hands dirty, just getting in with them and working with them. And if you're there in the trenches with them, they will listen to you.
Cool. What are some examples of, over the years you've been there, like things you've implemented?
Resuscitation of babies. And interestingly, after listening to podcasts, in the 1950s in the U.S., they decided when a baby was born, It was sink or swim, and it was all up to the baby. And that's a little bit how they do it in Kenya now. In the 50s, Virginia Apgar came along, an anesthesiologist, and she said, we have to give the babies a score, and then we have to resuscitate the babies. And when you first think about resuscitation, you think about cardiac arrest, CPR, no heartbeat. And the attitude in Kenya is, baby's got a heartbeat, he's doing okay. He doesn't need to be resuscitated. But there's a huge transition from getting oxygen from the umbilical cord to actually having to breathe through your lungs. And the babies need a jump start. So we've really been working on resuscitating all babies, giving all babies oxygen, stimulating all the babies, keeping all the babies warm. And they don't all need it, but if they get the idea that every baby gets resuscitated, the ones that really need it, they'll know what they're doing. And that's made a huge difference.
Cool.
Having just been involved in the capstone class, I'm curious whether you've introduced any new technologies as well or particular devices that have made a big impact for women and children.
They're really pretty progressive over there. IUDs are very popular, more so than birth control pills because it lasts for 5 or 10 years. Unfortunately, one of the biggest things that could change life in third worlds is that human papillomavirus vaccine, which is still too expensive. They're still working on trying to do pap smears on women, and if you could prevent it from the very beginning, it would be much more beneficial.
But that's cheaper,
but that's a public health policy. When I was there, I saw a 20-year-old woman that had stage 4 cervical cancer. And in the U.S., and the standard of care is don't even do a pap smear until age 20. So things are definitely different there. When we first started there, going to Kenya, they did a lot of home deliveries. That was sort of the standard of care done by midwives. So first we started making up little delivery packs to be sent out to the community. Since then, they've changed it so that deliveries in the hospital are free. And that's probably tripled the number of hospital deliveries, which has dramatically decreased infant mortality. When you show up at a hospital in Kenya, you have to pay before you get treated. So to have to pay for a baby, if the husband says, well, you can have the baby at home and it'll be free, a free delivery is a great lifesaver for women and babies.
Free delivery in the hospital?
In the hospital.
It sounds like in Kenya in the past, or like 8 years ago, home birth was a reality because of finances. But I feel like in the U.S., home birth is becoming a reality because it's like hip now. What are your thoughts on the recent, or maybe not recent, I don't know, the popularization of like home births, doulas, midwives, and everything on the spectrum between like a home birth by yourself and a birth in the hospital with an OBGYN?
Well, England has an excellent home birth program. And everyone that does a home birth is assigned a midwife and lives within 10 minutes of a hospital. So they've got an excellent fallback system, an excellent ambulance system, and you just don't have that in the U.S. It's too big a place. I think a home birth is a recipe for potential disaster. Women still bleed to death, and babies still have unexpected fetal distress. And in the U.S., approximately 20% of women have cesarean sections. So that's approximately, some of those are planned, but there's probably a 10% chance something could go seriously wrong. So I personally don't think home deliveries are good. I don't think it's worth risking a baby's life. Midwives are becoming more and more popular. The advantage of a midwife is they have more time. A midwife will stay with a woman the entire hospital visit, and on prenatal visits has more time to talk and explain and the whole gamut of a lot of different things. So a lot of women like midwives. If you're low risk, I think it's a viable option. Most midwives are licensed and they have OBGYN backups and they deliver in hospitals. So they just call their consultant, and the consultant takes over. A doula is a labor expert, unquote, that you hire that comes to the hospital and coaches you through labor. And my feeling is that's what the RN at the hospital is for. Some women really, granted the nurse goes in and out, some women really like the one-on-one. Some doulas are excellent. Some doulas are a little bit adversarial with the doctor. So
get a doula that believes in medicine?
Yes.
Do you have any advice for people who are beginning in their professional lives that you've learned in your professional life that can be useful to anyone, whether they're a budding OBGYN or a graduate student?
Yes. You're always going to run across difficult people that you have to deal with, that you can't ignore. Sometimes you can ignore them. I think generally the best option is to call them on it. I usually try to use humor and make them realize how silly their comment was. And I think you just can't let people get away with using you. When I first showed up in my office, they said, well, now there's five partners and everybody's got one day of the week. You can have Friday night. And I said, Friday night? If I take Friday night, I'm always going to be single. Then they changed the schedule and Fridays were rotated.
So speaking of your career, like, how was your transition from a trainee as a resident to an early career professional in your own practice?
It's much easier being a professional on your own. My first job was in California, and there were four other people there, and there was a woman. And the woman, Lois Levine, was a superstar for the entire county. Everyone loved her.
And this was Marin County, so this is like ritzy patients.
And everyone said, oh, we're so glad you're here. It's going to be so great to have another Lois Levine. Well, I was no Lois Levine, and I knew it. And I was just a raw recruit, so it was really stressful. But I watched what Lois did, and Lois could understand this is like a 10-minute gynecology appointment. She'd walk into the room and sit down and look the woman in the eye and say, Kayla, how are you doing today? And Kayla would answer, and you just felt like she was completely 100% there for you. She had nothing else to do that day except to take care of you. And it was really eye-opening. And so I took that approach and I learned it after I got my ulcer, trying to be Lois.
like metaphorically or like for real?
Literally.
For stress?
Literally.
Oh, no.
And then did Lois say, Katie, how are you doing today?
Yes, she did. When I went for my exam.
Wait, she was your doctor?
Well, of course.
That's kind of weird.
Who else am I going to see?
She's
I can't do it myself. I periodically see women in the office that think there's something wrong with them. Their breasts are uneven. Their labia are uneven. They don't feel anything when they're having sex. A lot of women really need to be told that, yes, they are normal. Breasts are hardly ever exactly the same size. It's very normal. It's not uncommon. Lots of women have 8 babies. Things are a little loose, and it works just fine. My message is you are normal, and find a gynecologist that can tell you so.
What are other myths that you're here to dispel?
Pregnancy. Oh, there's some brochures about pregnancy after 30. There's no big deal about pregnancy after 30. After 35, late 30s, 37, it might be a little harder to get pregnant, but there's no rush to have a baby.
Well, do you give that same recommendation to women who might struggle with infertility? And how do you know if that's going to be you?
Good question.
Birth control pills protect your fertility. They protect you against endometriosis and various other things. Various other things meaning you're less likely to get a pelvic inflammatory disease infection with birth control pills because the mucus is thick. But if you're 25 and you're not ready to get pregnant, it's not going to change much in 10 years. I mean, if you're infertile at 25, well, you're not going to know you're infertile. So to try to have a baby at 25 because you might be infertile later is a little bit strange thinking. I waited till I was older to have a baby, mostly because I didn't find a partner, but it was very satisfying. I didn't start till 39. It was a little bit more expensive to get pregnant.
Thanks, Mom.
But Sally was worth it.
My other question would be, like, if it's a question of career, I mean, that might be person dependent on when is the best time.
Well, absolutely. And a lot of women have kids when they're in the middle of residency, medical school, PhD programs. Although medical residencies have seriously cut the number of hours that people have to work, so it's not as onerous. It also depends on your partner and how busy he is with his career. There's a lot of careers that work at home or aren't as time intensive.
So live your best life. But use birth control if you don't want a baby.
Yeah. So grad student life, you're often working long hours. It may not be the best time of your life in terms of taking care of your health. How can this affect gynecological or cause gynecological problems, or can it? And do you have any recommendations for avoiding that?
I don't think stress and long hours specifically causes gynecologic problems. I think everyone needs to realize that they need a break, whether it's a physical exercise break or a mental health break where you just go walk in the park. But you need to take time in the middle of the day and recharge your batteries, and that you'll be much more efficient if you do that.
The stress of graduate school. Should we be stressing if our stress of graduate school is making our health worse?
Well, you need to be sleeping at night. You need to be eating healthy and taking breaks. So,
what if we're doing none of that?
Then you better start worrying.
Thanks for that comforting note from an experienced professional.
But seriously, I usually ask my patients about depression. Or if they seem stressed, if you have trouble falling asleep at night, turning your brain off, if you're cranky at work, if you're yelling at people that you don't feel like, that don't need to be yelled at, yelling at your children, not enjoying your partner or your children, you probably need some sort of antidepressant. And I think there's a lot of people out there that have benefited from mild antidepressants. One of my patients said, my children behave better when I'm on Prozac, meaning mom has a longer fuse and she doesn't gripe every little thing. So if you find yourself feeling depressed, not enjoying life, don't be afraid to ask your doctor about it. And a gynecologist is also a very good resource for that.
Excellent. Oh, this is so good. Kayla, anything else?
I don't feel like we've really had a fun time.
Oh, would you like to share something fun? Or Kayla, what was your thing?
No, go ahead. I think I can't really think of anything else, I guess.
No, but I feel like we had fun. We dispelled myths about contraception. We learned about the time you got a stress ulcer from trying to be as great as a superstar. Do you think that the young doctors at your practice have a stress ulcer from trying to be as great as you?
No, because... No.
Thank you very much for being our guest speaker today. And thank you, listeners, for listening to another episode of Double Shelix. And don't forget to like us. No, do you like on iTunes? Write a review.
Subscribe and review. Yeah.
Subscribe. Don't forget to subscribe and review on iTunes.
And you can follow us on Twitter @DoubleShelixPod. That's all for today. Thanks for listening.